You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Theater Geeks Anonymous. At this time, we ask that you turn off all cell phones, unless, of course, you're using them to listen to this podcast, in which case, please keep it on. And please refrain from any flash photography, as it is dangerous to the performers of this podcast. And now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Welcome!
I'm still crunching.
Ebony has a Thin Mint in her mouth, and I totally pushed record knowing that. We had to have something. We were having some technical difficulties, and it kind of continued on into today's recording process.
Lord, guys.
So I'm Pamela.
And I'm Ebony.
And you've reached Theater Geeks Anonymous. Did you like that?
That was amazing.
This is where we tell the story of Broadway flops, scandals, and new works. Broadway flops, scandals, and new works. Did you like that? Have you still got cookie in your mouth?
I think I'm okay now.
Oh, that's good.
I needed something.
Right?
It's stressful.
Cookies, man.
And then we got to talk about who fails, who sues. And we got to tell their stories.
Yes, we do.
Because, guys, it's been real rough.
It has. We've done a lot of laughing, a little bit of crying, lots of praying.
Yeah.
We're trying to get through. But hopefully, I think we've got it figured out right now. So what? Oh, we were going to talk about the show we went to go see this week.
We went to see Pacific Overtures at Classic Stage Company. It's on East 13th Street.
Yeah, in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm, by Union Square.
Mm-hmm.
Pacific Overtures is a show that's not done very often, so I definitely wanted us to jump on the chance to be able to go see it.
True, true.
And also, it's probably going to be an episode later in the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not in season one, but probably in season two, because the first incarnation that was on Broadway did not last very long.
Nope. We don't have any stats, though.
I don't.
You'll have to pay attention to the next time we do that in an episode.
I did listen to an episode of Behind the Curtain,
okay,
which is a podcast that I highly recommend and that I binge listen to. And I absolutely love the gentleman who hosts it. And they did an interview with the woman who was the casting director on that show.
Yeah.
And she just talked about how she went about casting that show and the difficulty in casting. And something that I have said numerous times is I feel like society and technology is just finally
figuring out
how to produce Sondheim. And we're just catching up to begin to like even understand
where he came from, what his motivations
were. And just because his work is so deep and so layered and so beautiful and so wonderful.
No,
and
I'm
also,
with you.
We haven't even had... There's not been, and still, we're struggling for opportunities for minorities to even be in musical theater.
Sure.
And so when they were producing the inaugural production of Pacific Overtures, the lengths that the casting directors had to go to...
Oh, to even find enough Asians to cast.
That's right. It's really a remarkable story. And
yeah,
so
no
that's
kidding.
Why I really feel like it's going to be important for us to do. So when I saw this production, I connected to it because the story is basically the westernization of Japan.
Mm-hmm. America basically came in, westernized Japan, took away all of their traditional heritage, mm-hmm. and then kind of gave Japan then the idea to westernize other countries that they wanted control over as well.
Right.
And it wasn't just America.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
It was all of the
Russia,
Western...
Yeah. The British, everyone just
Dutch,
came in and
yeah.
they wanted to be able to export and import goods. And because of that,
I think the issue at hand was the fact that they came in and they didn't want to accommodate Japanese tradition
absolutely
at all.
Not.
They wanted Japan to accommodate them.
That's right.
And that was why ultimately you were so angry.
Speaking as a minority, I felt like I come from a people group that was ripped from their country, treated like creatures instead of human beings, enslaved and westernized. Nothing of their culture was respected.
Right.
And so as we sat in the show, I'm connecting on that level with this production and the people and the characters in this show because that happened to my ancestors. you know,
they were misappropriated.
Well, definitely. And then I was watching another minority who was going through the same thing on their own land, which is like even worse.
Yeah.
Because it was their own land and their land is sacred to them. But I can understand the difficulty in connecting with like each character, I guess, on a personal level in terms of like what their personal story is. And
that was my trouble.
Right.
But to be honest, just in hearing what you just said, mm-hmm. you almost make that personal connection for me. Mm-hmm. I guess I was disappointed, but I also wouldn't give up the opportunity to see it again in its full version.
Right. Absolutely. I would love to see it in its full version.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I hope that this production does bring awareness to the show so that it is able to be produced in its entirety.
Sure.
But
well, there's a huge revolution going on in actors' equity right now based on the minority issue. I'm gonna segue because we are talking a lot right now into Kelly the Musical, which is also about an immigrant of sorts.
I think he really was an immigrant.
Well, I mean, in the show he was.
Yeah.
Well, I guess everyone is.
Yeah,
so.
We're all. Yeah.
All right, never mind.
Okay.
Here's the segue.
Okay.
Kelly the Musical. The synopsis is that it's set in the 1880s, and it's about a New York teenage busboy named Hop Kelly, who's an Irish immigrant. He's a sentimental daredevil who wants to make a successful jump from the Brooklyn Bridge and become a hero. He chickened out 3 times already. But he is surrounded by a group of Bowery gamblers who are betting against him surviving the jump, and they don't like the suspense. That's how they would say it, I imagine.
You think so?
I think so. They decide to throw a dummy off the bridge in his place, but Hop really wants to make the jump, and eventually he successfully does so. And curtain. So, in real life, Hop Kelly was actually based on a real guy mm-hmm. named Steve Brody. Mm-hmm. This was still based back in the 18... He was born in 1860, so this would have happened in the 1880s as well. On July 23rd, 1886, at age 25, Steve jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge and survived. Though, there's a little contention about that. So now I'm going to skip back about a year, a little more than a year. In May 1885, there was another man named Robert Odlum, who attempted to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge and actually died trying. He claimed that he was wanting to prove that people don't just die from falling through the air, so that if someone was involved in a fire, they would be more encouraged to jump out of that burning building and into the hammock that was waiting with the firemen down below.
Okay.
But it also said, and this is the funniest part to me, he also wanted fame and money. Don't we all? I wouldn't mind the money.
I mean, everybody wants some money.
I'd like that. So here's Robert's story. 5:35 p.m., he jumped from the bridge, but because it was super windy that evening, his body was turned while in the air, and he actually landed on his feet and his right hip when he was hitting the water. A friend swam out to him and was able to get him into a waiting boat, and he was alive at that point. So when he came to, he asked if he'd made a good jump. He then started spitting up blood.
Oh,
so he was not okay. It turned out that he actually had internal hemorrhage, and he died ultimately from a concussion. But it was also shown that he had a ruptured spleen, liver, and kidney, and that he had cracked ribs. You know what? They did a Mythbusters about that, too, where they, dumped Buster. Oh, man. It was good. Like, it was, like, at a certain height, like, every bone would have been broken. Every internal organ would have ruptured. What,
like, just in the air or once you hit the ground?
It's not the ground, just the water.
Oh,
because, water has that surface tension that is almost as solid as, a concrete ground.
I bet that Mythbusters is on Hulu.
I bet it is.
Mm-hmm.
Hulu. I don't know if I'm going to do one of those commercials. But actually, going back to Brody, after he jumped, people didn't believe that he made the jump. And I'm sure that it was probably because Robert had tried the jump earlier and he didn't make it.
Right.
So they were disputing the fact that he jumped and were making claims that his friends had actually thrown the dummy over the bridge instead and mm-hmm. that he happened to be in the water already and pretended to have made the jump successfully.
Okay.
But after all this happened, he became an actor and pretty much fulfilled his dream of being in the spotlight. So I guess he fulfilled his goal, which was to be famous. Anyway, oh, here, an interesting note, actually, is that a little over 3 months after Brody claimed to have made his jump, there was a man named Larry Donovan who actually did make the jump successfully. So I guess, I mean, nobody knows for certain whether Steve Brody made the jump or not. There's proof showing that it can be fatal, and there's also proof showing that it can be successful.
Do you know what happened? Like, what was it? What were the differences in the jumps? Like, why?
Well, that's why I mentioned that it was super windy that day, because they think that that was what ultimately made Robert die, where he could have been successful, because he didn't do it straight into the water. He was slightly off kilter. And so that's what they think happened. But who knows?
Right.
I mean, it was just his time. So I was going to tell you all of this information that I had researched, and then I came upon an article from the Saturday Evening Post in April 24th of 1965.
Oh, wait. I found it.
Yes, you did.
Because we got the second act trouble book.
Yes.
And I was at a coffee shop, and I was like, look at this! And I took a picture and sent it.
Yes, you did. So thank you. Because that meant that I threw all of my other research out the window in favor of doing just the story from the Saturday Evening Post, because it is fascinating. But there is one tidbit that they did not mention in the Saturday Evening Post, and that is that at the end of this show, they ended up losing $650,000. Now, if you know me, and you do, because we're friends and we're doing this podcast together, you will know that I was like, what would that be in today's money? Yeah. And so I Googled it.
Oh, no.
And I found out that it was $5 million in today's money. So that was back in 1965. That's how much they lost. Now, I'm going to go into the Saturday Evening Post story, but I wanted to give you just a little bit of information before I do. Basically, there were several producers, and I'll name them all in just a little second because they're important to remember their names. But the lead producer, who I'll introduce shortly, is the one that contacted the Saturday Evening Post and said, we want you guys to be in this process with us from beginning to end so that you guys can write a story. It's going to be amazing. You can have an all access pass. So
it's awesome. Right.
Like, it was completely unprecedented, and it still does not happen.
Right.
Because there's a lot that goes on. You'll find out. There's a lot that goes on in this process of putting a show together that does not need to be seen by the public.
Yeah.
And really, honestly, it's better that the public doesn't see it. I mean, like, you and I are fascinated, and I'm sure that there are other, lots and lots of other theater geeks out there that are equally as fascinated by this as we are. And so I guess maybe I am glad that they did this, but I also kind of understand that maybe it's not the best idea to do in the future. So here's the cast of characters in our Saturday Evening Post story. The lead producer is Joseph Levine. He was able to bring in $250,000 into this venture. He raised the most, or he brought in the most money.
Okay.
He was brought into it by David Susskind and Daniel Melnick, who were partners in TV production, which is, I believe, where they met Joseph Levine, who does a lot of movies and probably the TV as well. Susskind and Melnick brought in $150,000, and then rounding out the total of $400,000 was Columbia Records bringing in $50,000. But as far as I understand, at least in terms of the research I did, Columbia Records was really more of a silent investor. Then you've got the director and choreographer named Herbert Ross. He had been choreographing a lot, but had never directed. So this was his directorial debut. Then you've got the guys that wrote this musical. Eddie Lawrence, who wrote the book, he had written a lot for TV comedy sketches and did, he was a nightclub comic, but he was also an artist. That's going to come into play later on. And Mark Sharlip, who wrote the music, he had also written the music for Peter Pan with Mary Martin. So he was kind of a big deal at this point.
Wasn't he working on that at the beginning of this?
He was working on it while they were creating this music together. It was told basically that they wrote it back in 1959 in like 9 days of, and I quote, fierce inspiration. They called this a labor of love, though. So it was basically done on the evenings after Eddie had done his nightclub stuff and after Mark Sharlip had done his Peter Pan songs.
Okay.
So for all intents and purposes, these guys really just wanted this piece of art to succeed. They ended up attending every single rehearsal. They were very involved. And also, they said that the show was never produced before because several other producers that wanted to make it also wanted to make unacceptable changes to the script. That will also come into play later on in my story. They originally conceived the show as an ironic farce. I.E. Brecht, who wrote Threepenny Opera. So think very European songs that were meant as a commentary to the audience. They had, you know, major themes of social injustice and also a falsity of romantic love, they said. But they also really said that they were thankful that they had finally found producers who were brave enough to present such a play. This is what's difficult, because I think starting right from this moment, there was this huge either miscommunication or misrepresentation on the parts of the producers, because it seems to me that the writers had a very concrete idea of how they wanted this play to be, and the ideas they wanted to get across and how they wanted it to be performed and seen, like the feeling of it. And it seems to me that they may have just kind of been told by the producers, yeah, it's great the way it is. We're gonna do this. This is amazing. We're not going to touch it. But it's kind of a shame. But I'll get into this a little bit later, too. But that was just kind of to give you some insight. Lawrence was actually quoted as saying those other guys, meaning the potential producers that were earlier than Lawrence, than Susnick and Melnick, those other guys wanted to change the kid into some kind of knight in shining armor, like a crummy love story. So these guys, like I said, had a very, very strong idea of what they wanted and what they did not want. More that what they did not want, I think. Lawrence believed that artists' work were or was inviolable. And I think that goes back to his inviolable, meaning you should not violate an actor's work. Okay. You should not touch it unless the artist, I'm sorry, not actor, but the artist, unless the artist explicitly says that you can. It is the way that it is because the artist made it that way, and that is the way it should stay. Okay. He was actually trained as an artist in France. So he, you know, he's very eclectic. He's got a very eclectic background. But that was his stance on it. And Charlotte was quoted as saying that the play is something that I believe in. He says it thumbs its nose at cliche. They weren't attempting to appeal to the 12-year-old mind. They said that this is 1964, so it's against sentimental. There's no perfect fifths or octaves. I think that he means, like, there's no happy endings. This is real life. And then he says, you know, at least let me be wrong on my own terms. I hope that I still believe in it when it gets to Broadway. And then it was Levine's idea. He was the lead producer, as I mentioned before. He brought in the most amount of money. It was his idea to bring in Lewis Lapham from the Saturday Evening Post to do this whole story. And then he left. So basically, like, he was more of the money guy. And he said, okay, cool. You guys have my $250,000. I'm going to go back and do my movies in California. Melnick and Susskind were put in charge of this whole venture. But Levine had faith that they were going to be able to do it all on their own. And then he would just rake in the dough when it came. But Melnick also was quoted as saying that with any luck, you'll be able to write a textbook on how to produce a play in the American Musical Theater. I mean, like, is that narcissism?
You just never say things like that.
You don't.
You don't.
You don't want to tempt fate.
You don't know what it's going to be.
You don't.
You can't say this is going to be the greatest thing that anyone's ever seen. Like, you should never start writing something like that. It's true. You have to write a story because you're passionate about the story.
Right.
And you feel like the story needs to be told.
Right. And by all accounts, Lawrence and Charlotte both thought that that was the case with their story.
Right.
But I just think it's really interesting that the producers came to this man who they knew were going to be quoting them the whole time and just basically saying, hey,
a bunch of stupid stuff.
We're going to show you how it's done. Oh, so silly. Okay, so when the show started rehearsals, they had a month at the New Amsterdam Movie House, which I actually think is now the New Amsterdam Theater, which is on Broadway and 42nd. Is that right? the New Amsterdam Theater is there.
I think we'll have to Google that to make sure.
We would. I'm going to just say it. I'm just going to say it with confidence. But then after a month of working there, they moved to a larger rehearsal space at the Court Theater. Mm-hmm. It was quoted in the Saturday Evening Post that the actors at the point that they moved mm-hmm. were bored. That's the word he used. But he was saying, you know, like they would sit around, they would be reading their newspapers, they would be chatting each other up. It was also like, I can completely understand that though, because as a performer, it's like you get to a certain point where you're like, come on, let's like do this. Mm-hmm. Let's poo or get off the pot here. I said poo. But it is interesting to note that they had already spent a month and then they moved to a bigger rehearsal space, which also tells me that they had been rehearsing in like this shoebox of a place where they couldn't possibly have been able to do their numbers full out. And there were quite a few big dance numbers in this show because Herbert Ross was also a choreographer. Right. So he, you know, he made sure to have that at the forefront as well. Susskind, now see, this kind of leads me to believe that Susskind really didn't care about opening the show as much as just staying in rehearsal, yeah. because he was quoted as saying, the musical comedy is the only generic American art form. I would like to have one continuously in rehearsal. He says it's great therapy to come and watch the singing and dancing.
So here... I do find that theater can be therapeutic.
Absolutely.
But this is like, you just need a therapist, sir. You need to find a therapist.
Don't put the actors through. No. That's not what they're getting paid
Perpetual rehearsal?
Yeah. No. That's, I mean, like, ugh. Like in the 60s, it would have been considered a drag. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm going to say it with confidence. So at the end of the first week of rehearsals at the Court Theater, Ross, Melnick, Susskind, Lawrence, and Charlotte all gathered on a Thursday night to consider a possible elimination of a song sung by the characters of Frank and Jesse James, which was kind of like a sideline story within the broader spectrum of Kelly the Musical. Every time changes were brought up, Lapham said that the writers would resist it and Charlotte would actually have a physical reaction. He said that he would start twitching and then ultimately would just glaze over. So these writers were very hesitant to change anything about their script because they had such an emotional connection to it, which also is kind of a bad thing to have because it's never going to be perfect the first go around. No. It's always going to have changes.
Yeah. Writing is rewriting. And if you, it's true. And yeah. if you don't understand that, and if you're not willing to make the changes, then you're not giving your piece the room to breathe and be the best that it can be.
Sure.
And when you put the actors because to you it change. As well.
Oh, completely.
That's, I mean.
Completely.
Well, good writing is rewriting.
Right. Oh, goodness. So at the end of that week at the Court Theater, the cast actually performed for an invited audience of 100 friends and family. No one laughed or applauded very much, it said. And that was actually a quote from the Saturday Evening Post. So these were friends and family, and they were not keen on this show. Ross was quoted as saying, there isn't a page of dialogue that works, not a line. Melnick is quoted as saying that the audience is just too respectful. They feel that they're listening to poetry. It's just too honest. However, the consensus at that point was that except for a few minor problems in Act One, it was still in good shape. And although they expected changes when they got to Philly, they felt like it was a good product at that point. So, okay, I wrote in my notes, famous last words, all in caps, because this is what Melnick says before they leave for Philly.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
The wonderful thing about this show is that everybody is working together. There is none of that terribleness or that viciousness that those cliques common to most musicals. What we have here is unity. So now they've moved to the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia. They're having their first rehearsal. Costumes are shown, sets are shown, and they are considered to be a revelation. And I will say that they were very expensive. So that was a pretty very expensive, I should say, very expensive revelation. Costumes cost $90,000 and the sets were $100,000. So there's half their budget right there. The writers did not like them. They saw them as too real, mm-hmm. as too materialistic. Charlap said that the imagination droops and suddenly you're competing with My Fair Lady. He actually went on to say that in East Germany, they would understand how to do this play. This is where you get this breakdown in communication, right. where Lawrence and Charlap want this very minimalistic, very dark. You know, they wanted to do it in a black box theater.
It's like cabaret. It's like totally. Three penny opera.
Completely. Well, and it's three penny opera exactly, because mm-hmm. that was where they were drawing their inspiration from. Okay, so after the first rehearsal, it's 11:30 p.m. The rehearsal ended, and they had only gotten through the final scene in Act One, Ebony, from the whole day. Well, and maybe not the whole day, because I would imagine that maybe they would start rehearsal at like noon. So at least close to 12 hours. That's a long time.
It's supposed to be a 2.5 hour show, tops. Right? Maybe three.
And they had already been rehearsing for more than a month at this point. So there's a meeting in the basement, and Ross, the writers, and the producers are all there. Ross and the producers are all saying that Kelly's not sympathetic or heroic. Lawrence is asked to write three new scenes, and Charlap is asked to write a new song. They were very reluctant, but they agreed. When the writers left, Melnick called them okay, this part right here made me so angry, because they knew that there was a man in their midst that was writing everything down, that was going to be making an article about this. Mm-hmm. But still, when the writers left the room, Melnick felt comfortable enough to call them children, and Susskind thought them ungrateful. He said they ought to be down on their hands and knees for all the creative collaboration they're getting. So that's nice.
And it makes so any funny. Sense because it's the theater, and that's your job is right. to collaborate.
Well, so and a producer's job is to produce the show. You get the money and you put the show on. Yeah. If you had an issue with the show before you got it, then you shouldn't have taken it, or that's you right. should have made it very clear that these are the issues that you're dealing with beforehand.
Exactly.
But what makes, I guess it's so funny because I waffle between whether or not, you know, who I feel the most sympathy for. Right. And at certain points, I'm like, these producers are jerks. But then at the same token, it's like the writers were completely inflexible. Right. And so if they are inflexible and if they are unwilling to make minor changes, let alone major changes, which is what this play actually needed,
right?
Then nobody's going to be, then this show isn't going to be a flop.
Well, I mean,
because there's no way to do it.
It just sounds like no one was actually there to make theater.
Right. They all just wanted to make their point.
Right. Because if you're making theater, you're collaborating. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to make good theater is to work with other people, be flexible, be willing to change.
Yes. And that goes for both sides.
I mean, everybody. Everyone yes. has to be in it.
Every
to be
single
a community
person.
And to have actual unity.
Well, and you bring up a good point, too, because from the very beginning, you have to have every single person on board and supporting your show and to be as excited about it as you possibly can. And that includes all of the actors.
Right.
And they are already at this point bored, and they don't want to, like, there's always already this kind of feeling that they don't want to be there. So, you know, that's really difficult to kind of come back from. So December 26th is their first preview.
Uh-oh.
So I guess I imagine that they had like 2 days off for Christmas, and now they're back in Philly. Levine is back to see the preview. He's coming to realize that success and failure depends on 5 or 6 men in New York City, mm-hmm. i.e. the critics. The audience is unhappy. They overheard a woman that they termed as the lady in the veil. She was walking through the lobby after the show, and she said that she felt sorry for the cast.
Oh, dear.
Like, how sad is that? Ross, the director, is hoping for bad reviews. Melnick is relieved because they were right all along about it being a bad script. So, like, these guys are rooting against the show because right. they just want to prove their point. They right. want to be like, I told you so. We need to change this. The cast is drinking away their troubles. I think it was at the Variety Club. I think I have it written down later. but still they're holding to the old maxim. And I had never heard this before. Maybe you have. Philly audiences are always wrong.
No, I've never heard that before.
Okay, so maybe it was a 1960s thing. But one of the cast members was overheard saying that they hated West Side Story. So I guess that proves their point. Now skip to December 29th. They're at the Barclay Hotel. It's the day after opening night. Ross, Melnick, Susskind, they're reading all of the bad reviews. They are all criticizing Kelly as being an oaf and that the story is really tedious. The producers decide they're going to cut the James brothers from the show. As I mentioned before, that was the sideline. So you had Jesse and Frank James. They had a song that they were going to cut, but now they've decided to just cut those roles completely from the show. Mm-hmm. And move a more successful dance number in Act 2, they're going to move it to Act 1. And they're also going to insist that Lawrence write whatever they told him to write and to cut Kelly's opening soliloquy called Ode to a Bridge. So these are all things that they decided before the writers actually joined the meeting. That's when the writers arrive.
Oh, dear.
Understandably wary. Susskind reads the review that says, "It's a tedious story torpedoed by indecision." And he tells the writers that he agrees 100%. Melnick brings up cutting Ode to a Bridge, and he says it's no good. Lawrence says, "That's the show. That's the way it's written. It's written like that on purpose. It's like a bad poem. That's the whole point of the joke." And the producers say back to him, "Well, it isn't funny." And Lawrence says, "Well, my friends think it's funny," and he won't budge. So the producers decide they're going to drop that for now.
Wait, yeah. What friends? Because friends and family were there and didn't laugh.
Well, that was the friends and family of the actors. What I think he's talking about are like all of his friends that are in the nightclub circuit and also the TV comedy writing stuff. The thing is, I mean, look, comedy is objective.
Yeah.
I can think something is hilarious and you're like sitting there straight face and you could be laughing your butt off on something else and I'd be like, that is not funny. Right. So, you know, it depends on who's watching it. So, yeah, his friends might have thought it was really funny, but the bulk of the audience does not.
Right.
Or they just don't understand why it's supposed to be funny. Right. And in that, if that's the case, then you have to rewrite it. There's nothing that you can do to explain to the audience, like, this isn't an opera where you can write the synopsis or the libretto inside the program.
Right.
And that's, you know, oh, I see. This is why. Well, this is what's happening. I get it. You know, you can't have that in this musical. So in that respect, I agree with the producers. Basically, so then at that point, he won't budge. The producers decide they're going to drop that for now, and they're going to bring up Kelly's character flaws. They say he needs to be more lovable, and they request a new ballad from Charlotte. Lawrence says that he sees it turning into a Broadway spectacle and he hates it. So this is also where it comes into play. It's not going to be art. It's not going to be the art that they expected it to be. It's turning into like this Broadway show, this musical comedy in America. But that's what you wrote.
Right.
Like you're trying to produce a Broadway show in musical comedy. You know? Ugh. This is tough, though.
You need to do off-Broadway, buddy. Like, maybe. Do some smaller, mm-hmm. like, you
or, like,
a
write
black
the
box?
Movie first.
Yeah.
And then make the show out of it. But, yeah, I mean, like, that was my idea to do it in a black box.
Yeah.
Like, do it in a small little intimate theater and, like, really get word of mouth going. But, see, that's kind of the way that theater works here mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. As opposed to when it worked then. Right. Like then all people wanted was big spectacles. All they wanted was to go and see a Camelot or go to see a My Fair Lady. And they didn't really care to see anything artsy. And also, I mean, look, if you're looking at spending, and at that point in time, it was maybe like $21 a ticket. But mm-hmm. in today's money, it's like, well, how much are we paying for a ticket today? I mean, the cheap seats are, you can't get a cheap seat less than 50 unless you do like Rush
or
the lottery.
Musical. Right.
On
right.
a musical.
Except, right, on a musical. Because there are plays where you can get
sure.
less.
Yeah. But, you know, like if you're going to go see a show, if I'm spending this kind of money, you better wow me.
Right.
That, I guess that was where they were coming from. And it's certainly where I come from too mm-hmm. when I spend that kind of money on a ticket. Mm-hmm. Okay, so skip now to January 3rd. They are in a first rehearsal with the brand new scenes that were written. So I guess they did agree to write the new scenes.
Okay.
They're going to be performed the following night. That is actually that is what happens in musical theater. Like, if you're doing an original show, things will change all of the time. You'll get new scripts and you'll basically be performing them either that night or the next night. So mm-hmm. it's not for the faint of heart putting on an original show. So they get their new scripts. They find out that two of the actors were fired. Lawrence hates his new stuff and he's the one who wrote it. So, like, this is the rehearsal going into it. The cast sits down, they're handed new scripts saying, you're going to do this tomorrow night. By the way, we've fired two of your friends. And also, the writer hates what he's written. Welcome. Like, I can't even imagine the stress. But that goes to show you that basically writers wanted art and the producers wanted money.
Right.
And there was really no way to connect the two. January 5th, Barclay Hotel. New material was disappointing. The audience doesn't laugh. They have no sympathy for Kelly. Susk and Melnick demand changes be made. They demand changes be made. Like, that was in, when I read that in the post, I was just like, I mean, I guess, look, they must be getting frustrated at this point, but demand is kind of a strong word. Yeah. Ross.
Get more with honey.
Oh, I know, right? Ross blames an actress, Ella Logan, who plays Kelly's mother in the show. She was the lead in Finian's Rainbow in 1947, Ella Logan was. And she was hoping that this show would actually be her comeback to Broadway. Because mm-hmm. it's been a couple decades, I think, since she's been on the stage. This is a quote from Ross. He says, she's a cantankerous lady. She's so vulgar, I can't stand it. She's hurting us and she'll definitely have to go. And then Melnick, who I've just come to realize is a huge yes man, calls her cancer. It's like, you can't treat your people like that. Anywho, the writers then point out that she's the nearest thing to a star that they even have in this show. And she's the one receiving the loudest applause. And tickets are being sold directly because of her. Melnick says, well, her part is irrelevant and they're willing to take the risk. So she would be taken care of. Now, he says she's going to be taken. I know.
I just can't.
It's hard. I'm going to try to go through this quickly because it is hard. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. Melnick says her part is irrelevant. They're willing to take the risk and he's going to take care of it after Wednesday night's performance. Cut to Wednesday night. They're at the Variety Club. Now the Lapham is now with the cast who are all depressed. Rumors are circulating. They're hearing that there's going to be a new writer, that instead of going to Boston, they're going to go to Toronto so they have more time to work on the show. Don Franks, who is the actor that plays Hop Kelly, is losing confidence because with the rewrites, his performance has become less and less convincing. So he's just like moping around the Variety Club.
Oh,
I have to read this. I'm going to get the Saturday Evening Post. Can you hear it? Real paper. And it smells like real paper, too. I love the smell of old books. Ellen Logan came in at about 2 a.m., round-faced and sly, a woman in her early 50s, she wore a Hawaiian blouse and looked around the room with the exaggerated melodrama of a conspirator in a Shakespearean play. Talking softly among her supporters in the corner of the bar opposite to Charlotte, who I guess was also there, she reported Melnick's visit to her dressing room. That night, she said he had come to her and told her that her part was being reduced to 5 lines in the first act and 6 lines in the second act. She interpreted this maneuver as an attempt to humiliate her and thus oblige her, for reasons of her own pride, to quit the show. If she quit, the producers could say that she had violated the contract and therefore they were under no obligation to pay her.
This is so dirty.
Wait, though. This is why I love Ella Logan. She was having none of it. And she's like, you know, look, she's not a spring chicken in the business.
She's been around.
She has been around a long time. She says, but I ain't moving. I told him very politely I'd speak to my lawyer, but I ain't moving. I don't know how she actually, if she had an accent, but I just gave her one. So at this point, the cast is starting to resent all the behind-the-back stuff, and I can completely understand why.
Absolutely.
Because I've been in that kind of situation, and it is toxic. Thursday afternoon, Ross calls a rehearsal. Everyone is rebelling. The cast is scared of the critics, and they're feeling incredibly insecure. Halfway through the third scene, one of the actors throws his script and yells that it's terrible and he can't say these lines. What do they even mean? Cast members are now in tears. Others are saying something is fishy, but they don't know who to trust. Ross is saying, I know the script is bad, but changes will be made. You must not deteriorate under emotional strain. It's rough, but that's why we're out on the road. Melnick pipes in and says, we can't start acting like animals protecting our own interest. He then told Ella that she was destructive influence and asked her to cooperate. Then said, I love Ella again, you're going to love her too. He says, if the show's a flop, we'll all go back to television, ha ha ha. And Ella pipes in and says, you'll go back, some of us belong in theater. Mm-hmm. Ugh, mm-hmm. The writers, basically at this point, I mean, the writers had this contract that disallowed changes to be made without their approval. Okay. So they felt confidence because they had this ironclad contract that says, this is our stuff and this is the way it stays unless we decide that we're going to change it. But the producers are coming at them super hard. And so now it's kind of like mommy and daddy are fighting and the cast members are stuck in the middle, mm-hmm. which is terrible. And they're just using poor Ella Logan as a scapegoat, really. January 8th, they're at the Schubert Theater in Philly. Ross decided that at this particular rehearsal, he's just going to throw the script out and he's going to do some improv exercises with the actor. Or the actors. Lawrence comes in to witness this, but wasn't told beforehand. He leaves, has some words that are very loud with Melnick, because apparently they could be heard on stage, and then he leaves. Now here's the timeline. Same day, that's a Friday, January 8th, Melnick receives a telegram from the writer's lawyers threatening appropriate action if the producers continue to permit unauthorized changes to the script. January 11th, which is the following Monday, Susskind gives Ella Logan back all of her stuff in the show. Interesting that. Tuesday the 12th. Oh, and apparently, I forgot to mention this, Susskind was actually out of town through all of this. So okay. Melnick was the one making all of these decisions.
Okay.
And perhaps was the only one making the decision about right. Ella Logan, which is why Susskind felt confident and comfortable coming back and saying, you know what, just take your stuff back. We're going to do this right.
Right.
Who knows? Tuesday, January 12th, after the third revision, Melnick told Lawrence he was dried up, but we could bring in another writer to help you. His offer was refused. Uh-oh. On Friday the 15th, producers decide they're just going to do whatever they want. On the 16th, Lawrence and Charlotte are through with Kelly. Their lawyers file a demand for arbitration.
Uh-oh.
This is devolving very fast.
Yes.
On Monday the 18th, the writers seek a court order to stop the producers from bringing it to New York. So all of this happened in the span of just over a week.
It's crazy.
Isn't that
nuts? Absolutely nuts.
But it should have happened before it all went into production.
Yeah.
January 20th. Now they're at the Schubert Theater in Boston. It's a new theater, but it's a smaller stage, and they've got brand new material from a completely new writer.
Who's the new writer?
You know what? I didn't write it down. I think maybe his name was Goodman. Let's just say his name was Goodman. He was a good man.
He was a good man. Well, he tried to be.
He tried. It wasn't his fault.
It really wasn't.
Producers sought and won a temporary stay from the New York Supreme Court that would postpone the hearing until the following week. So they had an extra week now to change the whole show. Mm-hmm. And after opening preview, they said they needed more jokes. They still needed more jokes. I feel like they're like they've got their cigars and they're like, we need more jokes. What do you think, Lawrence? My friends think it's funny. I don't know.
Well, he's gone now, though.
Oh, yeah, he's gone. I'm sorry. He's gone. Okay. Next day, January 21st, they're at the Boston Ritz Hotel. The reviews are out and they are worse than Philly. Levine, he's done. He says, you guys have got my $250,000. I'm giving you nothing more. I'm out.
Yeah.
Now, there's no more money for the three-week run in Boston. The producers decide they're going to close after 1 week in Boston and move to New York early. So this is their thought process. We don't have enough money, and it's not doing well enough to play Boston.
But we're going to take it to Broadway.
Right?
Because that
so
makes
we'll
more
close
sense.
Early and open earlier in New York. Like, I just, like, the thought process, I just don't get it.
As if audiences in New York are going to be less... difficult.
Right. Less critical.
Yeah.
Well, I think at this point, too, I mean, they did have a press agent working on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And because everything was out of town and they didn't have the internet back then, mm-hmm. New York really was only hearing what the press agent gave them. Right. So it really was a strategic move mm-hmm. on their part to move to New York early. But Susskind still needs $50,000 just to finish that week in Boston. So now he's got to go find it. So the cast is assembled before the curtain that night, and they're told that they would be performing in New York in 1 week. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they are excited or not.
I know.
Lewis Lapham didn't go into that.
They're just like,
all right.
Weary.
Whoop-de-doo.
Yeah.
January 22nd at 11:30 p.m. So I'm assuming this is after the show has finished that day. Mel Brooks and Yay! Leonard Stern are flown into Boston to rewrite the show and add more jokes. By 2 a.m., it was decided, and like from 11:30 to 2 a.m., this is the mm-hmm. meeting that they were having. But basically, it was decided they were going to fire Ella Logan and hire a new songwriter to replace the song called Home Again. And a total of 9 out of 17 songs that were written by Charlotte had been cut at this point. And they were going to be writing 2 more scenes and several comedy routines to round out the book.
I'm sorry, guys. You can't see my face, but, like, I think my eyes are bugged. I can't.
It's really funny.
Oh, my gosh.
That's why I laughed. So that was January 22nd. They had the whole weekend to work. Now we're on January 25th, which is a Monday. They are at a dance studio on 6th Avenue. Cast is called into rehearsal. They're told that they're going to open on Saturday instead of Friday. They had a complete rewrite and that Ella's been fired. So let's get to work. Let's put on a show. So Brooks and Stern had rewritten the show from Saturday morning through Sunday night. Kelly was now the boy next door. There were comedy routines scattered throughout, but the cast was still skeptical and they were not feeling very confident. Skip now to the 27th, so they've had 2 days of rehearsals. The producers meet with the writers in hope of reconciling before the court hearing, which is the next day, but okay. That fails. Mm-hmm. So January 28th, they're at the Supreme Court in New York. Justice Samuel Gold hears the arguments and will hand down the judgment in a few days. There is so much more information that I could not put into this because it's such a long right. story, but I wanted everything in it, but I couldn't include it. So right. it's all in the Saturday Evening Post. Mm-hmm. So I think what I'll do is before we air this episode, I'm going to post it to the Facebook.
Oh, wait, but the copyright, we talked can't. About this.
Oh, boo right. face.
Yeah.
So I guess if you really want to know, message me and I'll tell you over the phone. No, I wouldn't do that.
No. Over
Maybe
Facebook
we'll do it in a mini
Twitter.
Episode.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
it'll
we
be one of our that. Intermission episodes.
Yeah. Corrections and omissions.
Yeah, but like the emotions. Arguments themselves are like, oh. So anyway, but I won't go into it because I can't tell you anymore.
Right.
February 1st, they're at the Broadhurst Theater in New York City. Susskind has gotten that $50,000 so they can delay the opening now until February 6th. Now they've got an extra week to work before they open in New York City. The judgment is for arbitration, which means they can keep going ahead with the show and make all the changes they want. February 6th, opening night. Writers attend with tape recorders because their lawyers told them to. Ella Logan, oh, love her. She's like a brass woman. Ella Logan attends just because she wants to. She just came with friends. There's not much laughter or applause, even with all of the rewrites. Reviews, though, don't come out until Monday. So now they have to wait. But then they get them, Ebony.
Uh-oh.
They are ruinous.
Wah, wah.
Wah, wah, indeed. Monday morning, they decide to close the show. So it's like, just give up the ghost. I mean, like, there were plenty of opportunities for them to have just backed
away. And not
away
have wasted millions of dollars.
And not have wasted almost, well, more than $5 million in today's money. I'm tired. That was a long story.
It was a lot.
It was a lot.
All that litigation, too.
Yes. I feel like at any point, if the producers had been more honest, if the writers had been more flexible, if the actors had been more excited, if, you know, if any of those pieces had come together, I feel like who knows? It right. may have
we
been.
Don't know.
And I will say that there is a cast recording. I have not been able to listen to the full thing, just the, like the little snippets that are available. Mm-hmm. But there was a new cast recording made because they did the show in its original form mm-hmm. in 1998 with mm-hmm. I Love Him, Brian D'Arcy James.
No, he's back in Hamilton.
Oh, I love
he's
him.
My favorite king next to Alexander Gemignani.
I remember you told me that.
Yes.
I will also say that he's doing this show on, it's a Netflix original called 13 Reasons.
Yes.
Why? 13 Reasons Why or just 13 Reasons. Mm-hmm. But he's so good. He's just so
just
good.
I love him.
I love him too. Oh, love you, Brian D'Arcy James, if you're listening. I hope you are. I'm tossing my non-existent hair right now. It's just very short. It's not non-existent. It's I'm not bald. Short. It's just yeah. a very cute pixie. Oh, yeah. But that's,
oh, that's
so it
cool.
is available. You can buy it. And like I said, it was the original version that Lawrence and Charlotte had intended. So that's kind of a neat story. Theater Geeks Anonymous on Facebook.
At TGA.
B-Way.
On Twitter.
TGABway at gmail.com. If you have questions or comments, you can email us there. Mm-hmm. Please like, share, and follow us on Facebook. Tell all of your friends about us because I know they'd love it.
Follow us on Facebook.
Yes.
You can message us on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, follow us on Twitter. You can message us on Twitter.
Rate, review, and subscribe. And let us know what you think, if you have any ideas or anything like that. And scene.
Break a leg. Bye.
Bye.
's Hinton's generation-defining novel is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.